In America, one is free to profess any view, any belief. One is a free citizen. However, let the American try not to go to church, or let him try to praise communism, and something will happen whereby he will stop working in the big little town. He himself will not even notice how it happened. The people who will get rid of him themselves do not believe in God, but they go to church. As for communism, well, that is something for Mexicans and Slavs. It is no business for Americans. Imagine this. You take an immense mountain chain, cut it at the root, turn it upside down, and push it onto even land, covered with forests. Then you take it out. What remains is the mold of a mountain chain. Its mountains are upside down. That is the Grand Canyon. Mountains must be looked at from below, the canyon from the top down. The spectacle of the Grand Canyon does not have its equal anywhere on Earth. Of course, we should have gone down to the bottom of the canyon and lived there for half a year in a log cabin with steam heating. But we only did what we could. Drove around the canyon in an automobile. Out of the Grand Canyon, there was a new road, untraveled yet by tourists. The tall, thick forests of the national park became gradually thinner, and finally disappeared altogether. It suddenly turned dark and cold. We ran out of petrol. We were hungry. When immediately, from around the bridge, a light gleamed, and we drove up to a house. Near the little house, we noticed, with a sigh of relief, a petrol station. The house represented what in Russian and in Spanish is called a rancho, but in English, a ranch. So, here in the desert, where for 200 miles around there is not a single settled habitation, we found excellent beds, electric lights, steam heat, hot and cold water. We found all the conveniences of any house in New York. This little house contains all of American life, complete comfort in a desert, side by side with the pauper wigwams of the Indians. No matter where you go as a traveler, to the north, to the south, or the west, or to New York, New Orleans, or New Jersey, you will see everywhere poverty and riches stand hand in hand at all the roads and at all the bridges of this great country. Here began the reservation of a nomad Indian tribe, the Navajo. This is one of the largest Indian tribes. It consists of 60,000 people. The Navajos loathe and detest their white-faced brothers, who have been exterminating them for two centuries, driving them into worse and worse places, and finally into a fruitless desert. The government, which formerly devoted itself to destroying the Indians, is now trying to preserve their small number of descendants. So-called Indian reservations have been built where the whites are permitted to trade with the Indians under state control. Having chased the Indians away from the fertile ground, they have reserved for them only a few pathetic parcels of desert, and this is regarded as a great act of benevolence. They have opened museums of Indian art. They buy from the Indians for a pittance their drawings, rug, painted clay bowls, and silver bracelets. Americans are rather proud of the Indians. Even so does the director of a zoo take pride in a rare old lion. On the border of California, we were stopped at the inspector's station. It is forbidden to transport fruit or flowers into California. The inspector pasted on our windshield a label portraying unnaturally blue vistas and green palms, and we found ourselves in California, in the Golden State. "California," cried Mr. Adams suddenly, "is a remarkable state. As a matter of principle, there is never any rain here. You will simply insult a Californian if you tell him that rain is possible here. If on the day of your arrival it rains anyway, the Californian will be very angry, will shrug his shoulders and say, 'This is something incomprehensible. I have been living here for 20 years. One of my wives died here, and another fell ill. Here my children grew up and graduated from high school. This is the first time I have seen rain. He laughed. Americans laugh and never stop showing their teeth, not because something humorous has happened to them, but because laughter is their style. America is a land that loves explicitness in all its affairs and ideas. It is better to be rich than to be poor. So instead of wasting time on thinking of the causes of poverty and eliminating them, the American tries in every possible way to acquire $1 million. It is better to laugh than to weep, so he laughs. No doubt, in the past, he has forced himself to laugh, just as he forced himself to sleep with the windows open, to indulge in gymnastics, and to brush his teeth. Subsequently, these things become daily habits. And now, laughter rattles in his throat, irrespective of his circumstances or his wishes. If you see a laughing American, it does not mean that something strikes him as comical. He laughs only because an American must laugh. We were rolling over the streets of San Francisco. This is the most beautiful city in America, apparently because it is in no way reminiscent of America. Most of its streets rise from hill to hill. An automobile journey through San Francisco looks more like a sideshow called American Mountains and presents the passenger with a number of strong sensations. Nevertheless, in the center of the city is a piece which looks like the flattest Leningrad in the world, with its squares and broad avenues. The other parts of San Francisco form a remarkable seashore mixture of Naples and Shanghai. Here, as everywhere else in America, was limitless wealth and limitless poverty standing side by side, shoulder to shoulder. But wealth here did not seem as depressingly monotonous and dull, while poverty was at least picturesque. We drove towards the Golden Gate. Here ends Lincoln Highway, the autostrada between New York and San Francisco. American technicians are people of amazing modesty. The end of their concrete masterpiece, which unites the Atlantic and the Pacific Oceans, they have marked with a memorial column only 3 feet high, on which are the letter L, a small bronze base relief of Lincoln, and the inscription, "The Western End of the Lincoln Highway." The names of the builders of the road remain unknown, and what of it? The people who a year from now will be driving across the bridges of San Francisco Bay will not know who planned and built them. Thanks to the kindness of the bridge builders, we were granted permission to look at their work. The San Francisco-Oakland Bridge, 8.5 miles long, consists of several bridge spans of different types. Now they were finishing the spinning of the steel cable on which the bridge will hang. Its thickness is almost a meter in diameter. That cable, hanging over the bay, is safely provided with a wire net for the workmen to walk on. We ventured to make a short journey along the cable. We felt as if we were on the roof of a skyscraper, with only this difference, that there was nothing at all under our feet, except a thin wire through which the waves of the bay were visible. A strong wind was blowing. Although the journey was quite safe, we clutched the cable with desperation. "How thick it is," said Mrs. Adams, our travelling partner, trying not to look down. "A beautiful cable," confirmed Mr. Adams, her husband, without letting the upper steel support out of his hands. "And now let us go higher," the guide proposed, "to the very top of the pylon." "What a cable!" Mr. Adams exclaimed. "I simply don't want to go away from it." "But we don't have to go away from it. We will go up alongside the cable," the guide said. "No, no. In this particular place, the cable is especially good." Mr. Adams looked down by chance and instantly shut his eyes. "An excellent, excellent cable," he muttered. "Write that down in your little books." Just as, long ago, thousands of cities, a score of deserts, and a score of states ago, we had been almost sucked in by New York. Our notebooks were filled with a multitude of notes, signifying the dates of business appointments, of business luncheons, and business cocktail parties. We were leading the life of business-like Americans, without having any business at all. Our free day was finished by a visit to a football match. The teams of two universities were playing, Santa Clara and Texas Christian. But before passing to a description of this event, which to some extent helped us to understand the nature of America, it is necessary to say a few words about American football in general. Football in America means this: the very largest stadium, the very largest congregation of people and automobiles in one place, the very loudest noise that can be emitted through the oral cavity of a certain creature with two hands, two legs, one head, and one hat put on aslant. It means the very largest appropriation of money. A special football press and a special football literature, stories, novelettes, and novels of football life. A big football match in America is an event of much greater significance than a concert by a symphony orchestra, a cyclone in Florida, a war in Europe, or even the kidnapping of a famous millionaire's daughter. The grandstands of the stadium, filled in the center, were almost vacant on the ends. Still, there were approximately 30,000 people there. At first, the play seemed incomprehensible and, therefore, not interesting. American football has nothing in common with European football. These games resemble each other so little that when in New York in a newsreel theatre, a portion of a football match between two European teams was shown, there was laughter in the audience. And so, for some time, we could not understand what was going on the field. People in leather helmets, looking a bit like sea divers, some of them in red, others in white, stood facing each other, their heads and backs bent, and for several seconds kept standing, without moving. Then a whistle blew, and these people dashed frantically away from their places. The reds and the whites got mixed up, as it seemed to us, seizing each other by their legs. Such a commotion occurs in a chicken coop when a polecat appears. Then they all fell on top of each other, forming a large pile of bodies in motion. The first few minutes we did not even see the ball, that is, we noticed it, but only for a second or two, and then again we lost sight of it. Gradually, we learned to follow the ball and to estimate the situation. By the end of the first quarter, we began to understand a little about American football, and by the end of the second quarter, we were already great experts, repeated the names of the best players, and yelled with all the other onlookers. It is terrible to say it right out, but Hollywood, whose fame has gone around the world hundreds of times, Hollywood about which in the last 20 years more books have been written than in 200 years about Shakespeare, the great Hollywood, on whose firmament stars rise and fall a million times faster than astronomers have told us about, of whom dream hundreds of thousands of girls in all ends of the terrestrial globe, this Hollywood is dull. Hellishly dull. And if a yawn continues several seconds in any small American town, here it stretches into a full minute, and there are times when one simply cannot muster enough strength to close his mouth. There you sit, your eyes squinting with boredom, your mouth wide open, like a trapped lion. Hollywood is a correctly planned, excellently paved, and finely lighted city in which live 300,000 people. All these 300,000 either work in the motion picture industry or serve those who work in it. We, Moscow theatre patrons, are somewhat spoiled by American cinematography. That which reaches Moscow and is shown to a small number of cinema specialists at nightly previews is almost always the best that Hollywood creates. Moscow has seen the pictures of Louis Milestone, King Vidor, Ruben McMullian, and John Ford. Cinematographic Moscow has seen the best pictures of the best directors. These directors, with the exception of Chaplin, who releases one picture in several years, make 5, 8, 10 pictures a year. But, as we already know, Americans shoot 800 pictures a year. All the more depressing, therefore, was the impression American cinematography left with us after we became acquainted with it in its own native land. In New York, we went to the motion picture theaters almost every evening. Usually, two feature pictures are shown during one performance. Thus, we must have seen more than 100 feature pictures alone. All these pictures are below the level of human dignity. It seems to us that it is degrading for a human being to look at such pictures. They're designed for birds' brains, for slow-thinking human cattle of camel-like lack of fastidiousness. Every evening we would enter a motion picture theatre with a vestige of hope and departed with the feeling of having eaten in all its detail the famous lunch number 2, of which we were duly sick and tired. However, the spectators, the most ordinary American garage mechanics, sales girls, storekeepers, liked these pictures. At first we wondered about it, later we were worried about it, and then we began to understand how it all came about. There are 4 main standard types of pictures: musical comedy, historical drama, a film of bandit life, and a film featuring some famous opera singer. Each of these standard types has only 1 plot, which is varied endlessly and tiringly. American spectators see one and the same thing year in and year out. They've become so accustomed to it that if they were presented with a picture that had a new plot, they would undoubtedly burst into tears, like the child from whom his favorite toy had been taken, though it was old and broken. For several days we toured the studios. On the territory of the studio, an entire city is built. It is the strangest city in the world. From a typical street in a small American town with a garage and a 5- and 10-cent store, we walked out onto a Venetian square. Right behind the Palace of the Doge could be seen a Russian inn. All the decorations are made to look like the original. Several steps away, you cannot believe that these monumental entrances into cathedrals, these coal mines, ocean ports, bankers' offices, Paraguayan villages, are made out of beaver board, coloured paper, and plaster of Paris. We walked out of the studio, and half an hour later were slowly rolling along with the automobile flood which was making its way to Santa Monica to breathe the ocean air. The great motion picture capital smelled of petrol and fried ham. Young girls in bright flannel trousers were busily walking the sidewalks. All the girls of the world congregate in Hollywood. Here the very freshest merchandise is needed. Crowds of those who had not yet become rising stars, beautiful girls with unpleasant, spiteful eyes, fill the city. Here we saw a man whose profession is, in all probability, inimitable. This man sat under a large striped umbrella. Beside him was placed the following billboard: Houses of Motion Picture Stars, from 9 a.m. until 5:30 p.m. Although the business day was at its height, no one engaged the guide, and on his face was expressed an irrepressible disgust for his foolish profession and for American motion pictures. Further on, we saw a young man standing in the middle of the pavement. On his chest hung a placard which read, "I am hungry. Give me work." No one walked up to this man either. The vastness of the ocean, the steady wind that blew towards the shore, the tranquil pounding of the surf, reminded us that in this world there is still life that is real, with real emotions, which do not necessarily fall within a set quantity of footage filled with tap dancing, kisses, and gunshots.